I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in anticipation of the Hoosier Environmental Council's annual symposium this Saturday, we're going to talk about climate change and the environment. We'll talk about how large the challenges confronting us are and what we can do individually and as a state to meet those challenges. We'll be joined by a great group of guests: Jesse Carbonda of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Kathy Licht, a geological science professor at IUPUI, and Dennis Schock of the Interfaith Power and Light Board. You can join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits at WFYI.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about climate change and the environment. We're fortunate to have as our guests Jesse Carbonda, who is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, John.
It's good to have you here. Kathy Licht, who is an associate professor of geological science at IUPUI. Kathy, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Dennis Schock, who is with the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Board and is a retired minister. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, John.
Good to have you here. You can join the conversation today by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, Jesse, I'm going to start with you since one of the kickoffs for this show, one of the premises is obviously you've got a big event coming up on Saturday. Could you talk with us a little bit about what Greening the State House is and what it means?
Sure, John. Greening the State House is the largest gathering of environmental advocates in Indiana. It's going to be this Saturday starting at 9:30 at the University of Indianapolis Schweitzer Hall. And I guess in a nutshell, it has three main goals: to educate, empower, and to celebrate. To educate in terms of bringing in a keynote speaker to talk about the extraordinary challenge of climate change and panels involving both Republican and Democratic lawmakers. Empowering in so that people can get demystified about how the legislature works and be more effective. And finally, to celebrate.
That's presuming that it does work, right?
Work more effectively.
Okay.
And to celebrate. Celebrate folks like Senator Richard Lugar, who's going to retire, obviously, at the end of this year and has done some great things for the environment.
And Dennis, I'd also, while we're sort of working our way through the introductory statements here, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about what Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light is, what your mission is, all of that sort of stuff.
Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light, well, first of all, let me clarify, it has nothing to do with Indianapolis Power and Light. Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light is a state charter for a national organization called Interfaith Power and Light. That's a religious response to climate change. And statewide, we have a mission that we've written out for ourselves, bringing Hoosiers of faith together as stewards of creation in order to promote energy conservation, energy efficiency, renewable energy, and related sustainable practices. So we're truly interfaith and involve a number of congregations throughout the state in this activity of caring for creation.
Okay, well, I think we've got the table set now, so I'm going to throw this one to Kathy Licht. If you could, we hear an awful lot about climate change, and it can be confusing to people. What is it specifically? And, well, let's start with that. Just what is climate change? Let's start with the definition.
Okay, you can think of climate change in a number of ways. It's more than just global warming. So warming temperatures are part of what happens during climate change, but there are also changes in precipitation patterns, changes in rates of rain, so there may be more flooding events. So we see a whole variety of ecosystem changes in response to changes in precipitation and temperature.
And what are some of the manifestations of climate change? I'm presuming, you know, obviously with a lot of the coverage, they've talked about how the weather patterns have become a lot more volatile in recent years. Is that one of them? And if so, are there others?
Yes. Yeah, so here in Indiana, we are likely to see more volatile weather patterns, as you mentioned, and they are predicted to be more extreme temperatures during the summertime, in particular, up to a month over 100 degree temperatures, and more extreme precipitation events, particularly in the summer and winter. So they will be wetter at those times, which is, of course, springtime is crop planting time, so that's a bit tricky. And in the summertime, then prolonged drought interspersed with higher precipitation. On a broader scale, there are things like sea level, which is an extremely important aspect, particularly in light of Superstorm Sandy that just came through. And overall, big changes in water distribution, which is incredibly important all around the globe.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. Your question, please.
My question is, a smart grid is one of the many solutions to solving the great energy problem. So I think, oftentimes, many people overlook this as a key part to a solution. So my question is, what's the state of the current development of the smart grid in U.S. and India, such as, like, legislation? And when can we expect the smart grid to be completed? And how can we, especially Hoosiers, utilize and mobilize more support for a smart grid?
Thank you for the question, Charles. We'll try to get an answer for you. Well, Jesse Carbonda, that seems to be the one directed toward you, so we'll start with that.
Sure.
What is a smart grid first? We need to know what we're talking
it's,
about.
It's something of an amorphous term, but at a very, very high level, it's about upgrading the transmission and distribution system and also upgrading the IT infrastructure associated with that physical infrastructure, with the end goal of reducing consumption on the part of homes and businesses. And there have been a couple of pilot projects for smart grid in Indiana over the years, but it's been somewhat controversial because it's still a relatively new technology and its capital costs can be pretty high. And so what we wanted to focus the energies of our supporters on is really to focus on other ways of cutting carbon and reducing energy consumption, such as more classical low-cost measures of improving investment in energy efficiency.
Such as?
Well, one of the most important priorities that we've been focused on the last couple of years is something called PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy Bonds. It's a concept that's been adopted literally by all of our neighbors, and the idea is to provide a new source of capital for small businesses to invest in clean energy, such as energy efficiency improvements and renewable energy, so that they can reduce their energy consumption and also green the electricity sector.
Well, and when you talk about all of our neighbors, do you mean neighboring states?
Exactly. Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Ohio, Michigan. All those states have adopted this, and we think that there are smart bipartisan solutions that we can advance, even in this politically difficult context, to promote clean energy and also to address climate change at the state level.
And Dennis Schock, Jesse mentions the fact that some of the initial costs for some of this technology can be pretty daunting and force people to back away from it. Is that one of the challenges we face in confronting this problem as a society?
Well, it certainly is. As a retired pastor, very concerned about the impact on the poor and the middle class and the costs that might be incurred in addressing climate change and increasing efficiency measures such as PACE or the grid, the smart grid that they were just talking about. But in the long term, our feeling is that we have no choice,
mm-hmm.
that there are going to be some costs, but in the long term, it'll save us immensely by investing in the future through energy efficiency measures and through carbon reduction in whatever way we can do that.
Well, and I'll throw it now to Kathy sure. Licht and just say we've talked a little bit about this, and I realize I probably should honor one of the principles of storytelling here and start with the beginning, which is how did we get to this point? I mean, we've now pretty well established that climate change is a problem that we're going to have to confront. What brought it on?
The main onset of climate change is related to the Industrial Revolution. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s, we really started using energy at a much more rapid pace and figuring out how to use coal in a widespread way, as well as petroleum products. With the development of petroleum, we're burning carbon, and as soon as you burn a carbon product, you produce CO2. So the more energy we use, given the kinds we're currently using, which are carbon-based, the more carbon dioxide we make. So since carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, we know those gases are absorbing heat, the more the planet will warm.
Is there any consensus about what a safe level of energy consumption would be?
I think that's a very difficult question, and it depends on your perspective. If you are in a relatively comfortable environment and are a relatively wealthy nation, you might be able to tolerate a different level than a country that is extremely poor, where many people are living on the edge already. They can tolerate a little less push than countries where we have sort of more creature comforts, if you will.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or shoot us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jesse Carbonda, I'm going to ask a similar question here. Is there a target? Maybe this is another way to rephrase that. Rather than asking whether there's a consensus about what would be an acceptable level, is there a target that we should be aspiring to get to in terms of you know, climate change and using non-renewable sources of energy?
Well, you know, I think that the proper carbon policy needs to be constructed at the national and at the international level. But I think because of the moral gravity of climate change, we've got to construct policy solutions to cut carbon at all levels of government, particularly because things are paralyzed and continue to be paralyzed at the federal level. So I would say, you know, that we're not advocating for a specific greenhouse gas target in Indiana per se. We're asking for a much more aggressive reduction in carbon than is currently happening, and we think it can be done in a cost-effective way.
And how, when you say it can be done in a cost-effective way, what way are you recommending?
Well, you look at the two biggest sources of carbon in Indiana, and they are for certain the coal-dominated power sector and then the transportation sector. And so we'd like to see a more aggressive diversification towards more energy efficiency, more combined heat and power, more commercial-scale renewable energy, more small-scale renewable energy, and certainly to natural gas, which is much less carbon intensive than coal. That coupled with investing in public transit to a far greater degree than we are right now, and potentially in high-speed rail, I think are kind of the mix of policy solutions that we think will decarbonize Indiana and make us more robust as an economy in the long run.
Well, and Dennis Schock, you know, when I'm sure there are some people out there wondering how this became a faith issue to some degree, why churches began to get involved in this. You've mentioned the fact that you see it as a moral issue. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Certainly can. I'm glad Jesse mentioned the moral side of this. We in the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light see this not only as a moral issue that involves how we treat humankind and treat one another, and how we care for future generations. That's a moral issue, but it's also a spiritual issue, taking care of creation. And many of us refer to scriptures that have us caring for creation. That's part of our purpose on being on this earth. Every major religion says something about caring for your neighbor, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. And so that moral imperative is to care about what we do to the earth because it affects our neighbors and affects our grandchildren who are to follow.
So there is a sense of being custodians as well.
That's right.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jesse Carbonda, who is the Executive Director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Kathy Licht, who's with IUPUI, and Dennis Schock of Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Board. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, Executive Editor of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about climate change and the environment. My guests are Jesse Carbonda, who's the Executive Director of Hoosier Environmental Council, Kathy Licht, an Associate Professor of Geological Science at IUPUI, and Dennis Schock, who is with the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Board and is a retired minister. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I sense in this conversation at the beginning some hesitation to talk about really what the target would be, a specific target. What would define success here? And I'm not going to mischaracterize this. I'm going to pick on Kathy here a little bit, and I hope she will not take it personally or whatever. But some of it, I think, if there are people out there who are listening saying, "Well, this problem started with the advent of the Industrial Revolution and our energy consumption," they might be hearing, "Oh gosh, we need to roll back the entire Industrial Revolution and go back to a much more pastoral lifestyle." That's not necessarily it, is it? I'll throw the answer here, or the question to Dennis Schock. We're not talking really about rolling back time.
No, we're not. We're talking about a brighter future, and a future in which we'll have something similar to our present lifestyle, but one that's much saner, one in which we burn much less carbon, and one in which yet we can enjoy the benefits of the modern age, health care, and good homes where we can stay warm, where we can still travel, enjoying many of the benefits of modern life. We're not talking about going back to the Stone Age.
Well, and I guess when we talk about making this a saner world, what parts specifically of what we're doing right now either have to be severely curtailed or eliminated? Jesse Carbonda.
Well, I hopefully we don't need to frame it in terms of severely curtailed. I mean, certainly there will be sacrifice. I think there already is sacrifice in terms of the damage that climate change is doing. You know, you read with alarm about the fact that in 2012, every single county in Indiana was declared a disaster area. So there's been a lot of hurting of farmers in our state and across the country. And so I think, you know, we have to proactively begin to address this. And I think I'd like to build on Dennis's point, which is that we can lay the groundwork for an economy that I think will be much more compelling, the kind that will be a magnet for bringing in new talented people in the state and retain our great Hoosiers here. And I'm thinking of the fact that if we make the right policy choices, we'll have more investment in clean energy, which means more jobs for our state. If we have a more robust public transit system, it's going to have appeal to a number of different demographics in our community. And if you think about what Kathy mentioned about the way in which climate change is hurting agriculture, Indiana could become an even greater hub of innovation in agriculture than we already are in terms of conservation tools and technology.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. Larry, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Certainly.
I just wondered if our guests are aware of the position that our new governor will have on some of these solutions that we're talking about to the climate change problem. How amenable is he to things like mass transit and some of the other things that have been suggested?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Larry. Well, I'll throw that one first to Jesse Carbonda. Have you reached out to Governor-elect Mike Pence yet?
We have.
Did he reach back?
Well, we engaged. We started conversation. We knew that there was a good likelihood that he would be elected governor, and we actually engaged with the Gregg campaign too in the spring of 2012, and we met with a couple of Pence's senior policy staffers back in the spring, and we've certainly reached out to the governor-elect team recently, and I know that there are strong presumptions out there about how he will act on environmental issues based on his congressional record, but it's our hope that he takes a more pragmatic view and recognizes that there are ways to construct policy that will emphatically improve the jobs environment in Indiana, which I know is his number one priority, while at the same time tackle really serious environmental challenges.
And I'll throw this to Dennis Schock, too. I mean, Mike Pence has made no secret of the fact that his faith is the guiding, perhaps animating principle in his life. Have you thought about attempting to engage with him in that kind of conversation?
Yes, I have. I would welcome the chance to engage with Mike Pence on that issue. I know he has stated that climate change is an issue of debate among scientists, and I feel that people of faith need to be informed by the science, and in this case, 98% of all scientists support the fact that climate change is being caused by human beings and that it's a critical, urgent issue. He sees that differently, and maybe partly because of his faith, I don't know. It would be good to talk to him about that.
Yeah, Kathy Licht was shaking her head rather aggressively when you were talking about how Governor-elect Pence was saying that there's a disagreement among scientists about climate change.
Yeah, that's not picking on him in particularly, but generally in the U.S. there's a perception that, we're still unsure about climate change, and that's just not true. The data are very clear, the temperature is rising, and we know that there are a lot of changes happening on the planet. So I think it's important to note that in the scientific community, there's a lot of clarity about what's happening on the planet right now. What to do about it targets specific details in particular areas may be debated, but we have a very strong overall sense in the scientific community about the nature of climate change.
Jesse Carbonda.
Real quickly to build off of Dennis's point regarding Governor-elect Pence, I think what we're encouraged by is that there are people who are evangelical as well, and yet also believe in climate science and to the consensus that Kathy was alluding to, that there is a way to reconcile science and devout faith.
Well, we've gotten a question here that I think is on point from a listener who did not want to go on the air named David, who says, can the panel speak on climate change when climate change basically became a partisan issue? And I'll throw that one to Jesse Carbonda first.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there's been a lot of anxiety, of course, about our economy, the high unemployment rate we face in the country, the extraordinary debt we face, and I think that's partly driven it. But I think there are Republicans, prominent Republicans, even to this day, who believe this is an issue we need to address. I'm thinking about conservative Catholic Sam Brownback, the governor of Kansas, or evangelical former governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota. And there has been a decline, certainly, in that kind of bipartisan consensus, but there are leaders in both parties that are there, and it's our hope that through forums like what we're having on Saturday, we can reignite that sense that this is an issue that affects all Americans regardless of their political party.
We've got an email question from a listener named Mac, who says, please ask your panel to comment on the effect of building the Keystone XL pipeline. If we don't build it, what economic activities might we take instead? How might this affect Indiana? I'll start, I guess, first with Dennis Schock on that one.
The Keystone pipeline is something that HIPL does oppose, and basically because it's one of the dirtiest, most polluting kinds of oil that can be used. It takes a lot of refining. It takes a lot of water to mine that. It's dangerous piping it across the country. as far as what kinds of things would replace that for the jobs that might be lost, my understanding is the number of permanent jobs that would be involved in that pipeline really aren't that many. And in the long term, investing in clean energy, wind, solar, would provide more jobs and more permanent jobs than the pipeline would.
Jesse Carbondo, what would you say about the impact of the pipeline?
Well, we always look at projects and policies from the lens of how are they going to impact the economy, how are they going to impact the environment, and if we believe that there's a compelling case that they would make advancements in both those areas, then we'd support it. The Keystone Pipeline is problematic from an economic perspective. Yes, it would create construction jobs, but that tar sands oil, that tar sands processed oil, is destined for export markets. So it's unclear if it's going to really have any impact on energy security or on oil prices in the Midwest. So it's problematic from an economic perspective. And then, of course, from an environmental perspective, going back to Dennis's point, you've got all sorts of issues in terms of the carbon footprint of tar sands, in terms of the groundwater that could be contaminated by this cross-continental investment going over the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the source of drinking water for literally millions of Americans. And we'd like to see that money invested more in energy efficiency, making our cars, making our trucks more cleaner, more greener, and that will produce more jobs per unit of energy than this tar sands pipeline would.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Catherine, who says, hi, great show. Thank you very much, Catherine. I love what Dennis Schock just said about the moral call to care for one another through our nurturance of the earth. I would also add that a major part of caring for the planet involves improving our relationship with all life. You can't love something you don't have a relationship with. So by getting out in nature and enjoying it more, we begin to build a context of appreciation for the earth. Then making choices that are more earth-friendly will be a natural expression of our care. Thanks for talking about such an important topic. And thank you very much for listening, Catherine, and sharing that comment. I think I'm going to actually kind of pose a question out of this, and I hope no one will take any offense, but, you know, the caricature of environmentalists, people who are environmentally conscious, is not always a flattering one. You know, they're perceived to be scolds of sorts, people who, you know, who don't take joy in things. And what Catherine's really saying here is that it should be about, rather than scolding, it should be about embracing. Is there something to that? Dennis Schock, you're the one making eye contact with me at the moment.
Yes, I am. I'm a longtime backpacker, and one of my favorite activities is to hike in the wilderness and to be in contact with all creation, with the wild animals and the beauty of creation. Most people do enjoy nature on that level, but I think we have lost contact with nature by insulating ourselves so much within our homes and communities, and we view ourselves as separate from nature.
Rather than being part of it.
And we're really a part of it.
Yeah.
We arise out of the earth, and we're a part of the earth, and we need to be in communion with creation.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. Why don't you connect with us by shooting us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. I was wondering if our panelists could comment on mass transit here in Indiana and the effect that has on our environment and where they see that, you know, going here for us in Indiana.
Thank you very much for the call, Jessica. I'll throw that one first to Jesse Carbondas, since you've mentioned mass transit several times already.
Yeah.
I'm gathering it's a priority.
Well, it certainly is. Yes, it's one of our top three priorities, and we're enthusiastic backers of this IndyConnect plan that has been proposed to dramatically transform the public transit system in central Indiana. It has the backing of, I think, around 120 different organizations and city entities, and then literally thousands of Hoosiers across the region, making the kind of investment that we need so that we're at parity with comparable cities like Charlotte and Cincinnati and Salt Lake City would obviously have dramatic economic benefits for our community, but also environmental benefits in terms of leading to more concentrated investment along the potential light rail line and or near the expanded bus lines, and then, of course, reduce pollution, because it turns out that the biggest source of air pollution in central Indiana and in other metropolitan parts of our state is actually coming from cars and trucks.
We're talking about climate change here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I want to pick up on that, Jesse, because obviously mass transit was something that the legislature discussed in the last session, and it, no pun intended, ran into a significant roadblock. What happened there, and, you know, what would happen to get it brought out of neutral, as it were?
Yeah. Well, I think, unfortunately...
Tortured a metaphor there, but that's okay.
Right. Right. Well, I think, for one thing, the legislative session alternates between a short session and a long session. So last session was a short one. It was just less than 3 months long. That was a problem. The second thing is that public transit got wrapped into this very controversial labor legislation, and there was a proposed amendment that was put in that was seen as something of a poison pill for some of the big transit backers that compel them to vote against a bill that they otherwise liked. We don't see that being a factor as we head into the 2013 session, and what we're very encouraged by is that you've got both Republican and Democratic lawmakers who've embraced this. Folks like Jerry Tor and Cindy Kirkhoff are Republicans from the central Indian area.
We're talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by shooting us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connecting with us on Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, I want to take a more global kind of step back here, and we focused very specifically on some things, and I realized we've sort of jumped ahead of where we might be on this. Kathy Licht, what are some practical steps we could be doing first as individuals to meet the challenges presented by climate change?
Yeah, I think first you have to recognize our individual roles in how we contribute to climate change. So the ideas of promoting conservation as Jesse and Dennis were both talking about are extremely important. So there are lots and lots of different ways we can reduce our own carbon footprint, our own use of energy. And I think it's also important to really think about educating ourselves. So as you said at the start, there's a lot of mixed information that comes through the media at times about climate change. And so I think, you know, learning about what the facts are is extremely important to help motivate us to make changes. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a fantastic resource that I would encourage people to check out. It's a summary of tens of thousands of scientific studies that really summarizes the nature of science. And so to look for the kinds of impacts that are likely to happen, I think that's a great resource so we can make the needed changes.
Real quickly, if people wanted to access that information, is there a URL or someplace they could go to?
It's ipcc.ch, or you can Google IPCC. It's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And the new plan is coming out in the next year or so. They'll make the next revision.
Great. We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I am John Kroll. I'm joined by Jesse Carbonda, Kathy Licht, and Dennis Schock. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about climate change and the environment. My guests are Jesse Carbonda, who is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Kathy Licht, who is associate professor of geological science at IUPUI, and Dennis Schock, who is with the Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light Board and is a retired minister. Well, I want to pick up on that a little bit because, you know, we've done a pretty good job of talking about how large this problem is, I think, and convincing people that there is a problem. There is some responsibility, I think, on our part to try to talk about, you know, how we meet it, what steps we should take. I want to start first at the individual level, which is where Kathy was talking at right before the break. Dennis Schock, can you give us three or four, you know, practical everyday things that people could do?
Well, sure. Hoosier Interfaith Power and Light makes this a part of its mission to help people who are members of congregations to take practical steps to reduce their carbon footprint. And we have a program called Task of the Month program, and we merely help people find one thing each month, a small thing that they can do to reduce their carbon footprint. Things such as turning down the thermostat at night, programming that thermostat, hanging clothes out to dry occasionally. Of course, putting in the light bulbs, the CFLs, or the LEDs. But there's just a large number of things that can be done, and we help them get started. And we've had very good participation in this. People are wanting to know how they can personally become involved in reducing their carbon footprint.
And I should, since I let Kathy give a URL, do you have a URL that you would like to direct people to where they could access this information or these steps?
Well, yes, our website, www.hoosierIPL.org.
Okay. Jesse Carbonda, I'm going to take it to you two real quickly. What are some practical steps individuals could take to meet this challenge or this problem?
Well, I might sidestep that just briefly in that I think that what we're encouraged by the kinds of steps that that folks are taking, and I think Dennis and his group does a wonderful job articulating the ways in which people can make a difference in terms of reducing their environmental and carbon footprints at an individual level, and we know that that will continue. But what we want to see people do as well is become more green-minded citizens. There's just an extraordinary lack of participation in our state in communicating views about the environment to people's elected officials. That's what we want to see. What's extraordinary is you'll talk to legislators regardless of their political party, and they'll tell you, you know, it takes just five or six folks in my constituency to really get me to pay attention to this issue. And even for on that bar of just five to six people, I don't have people talking to me about pressing environmental issues.
We are talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a Facebook comment from a listener named Jared, who says, slap some solar panels and a bloom box on that, baby. Leaders need to lead. I think we're moving to a larger perspective here on what people could do. How much of this is about, how much of this solution is about finding alternative forms of energy? We've talked about limiting our consumption of the more traditional ones, the ones that aren't renewable. How much of this problem, Kathy Licht, is about that, finding alternative ways to fuel our lifestyles as they were?
Well, I think that is one of the essential pieces. As long as we use carbon, the carbon dioxide will continue to increase. It has been a great resource for us, and it has fueled amazing things on this planet. And, you know, now we have the opportunity to really continue innovation and find alternative fuel sources. And that really is the way to cut down our carbon footprint. We also need to be cognizant that all the alternatives are not free of environmental challenges, and so we need to be very thoughtful and mindful about the kinds of alternative energies we're pursuing.
We have gotten a comment from Christopher, question, it looks like, who has self-published a climate change paper, feels that a famine is upcoming with a cooling period. Mainstream believes in global warming. What about a famine? They are related. When will that happen? Jesse Carbonda, or he's gesturing toward Kathy Licht. So I guess, Kathy, you drew the short straw there.
Well, I don't think any of us are prognosticators and can say and can predict the future of things like famines. I think all of the scientific data lead us to the idea that warming will continue. We've put CO2 in the atmosphere. It has a long residence time, and so the world is committed to warming.
Well, let me reframe then the question a little bit. I mean, if we don't do anything, we've already seen some consequences, presumably, with the storms becoming more violent and all of that. What are the other likely consequences of not doing anything? Jesse Carbonda or Dennis Schock here.
Well, famine is happening already because of the consequences of climate change that is causing drought around the world. This is especially a problem in Africa. And right now, millions of families are facing hunger issues every day because they can't grow their food. And that's partly because of weather patterns changing, brought about by climate change. And this is a part of the moral issue that we see from a faith perspective.
You know, and just
Jesse Carbonda, yes, please.
Yes, and to build off of Dennis's point, I mean, one of the stunning statistics globally is that about 40% of the world's population lives near water bodies. And with virtually every climate model predicting sea level rises, you're going to have this disproportionate impact on the world's poor. Even bringing it close to home, again, you see this issue that there's this greater and greater likelihood that we're going to have more and more droughts, depressing crop yields, and really hurting the agricultural economy. And I think, you know, that's an issue that we've really got to spotlight, which is that there is going to be tangible damage to different economic sectors, the recreational economy, the agricultural economy, those industries that are heavily water dependent that we have got to proactively plan for. And unfortunately, Indiana doesn't have a state climate plan. And it's one of, I think, about a dozen states in the United States that do not have such a climate plan.
Well, what is it? I should take a step here. And, you know, all of this sounds like it's a problem that we ought to be confronting. But one of the themes I'm picking up in your conversation is that this is something people just don't grasp, or they're not taking it seriously, or they don't put it at the top of their priority list. What's keeping people from taking this seriously? Jesse Carbonda.
Well, you know, one thing that I like to impart is that it's so important for us to be empathetic to the situation that our state faces and our country faces. You know, we do have a high unemployment rate. We do face these extraordinary economic challenges at the national level, fiscal challenges. And so there's a lot of things that are causing stress on our policymakers and on individuals. But I think that from every lens, health-wise, economic-wise, climate change is going to have such profound consequences on Americans, and we have to continue to do a better job in making people appreciate that virtually every aspect of a person's life will be affected by climate change increasingly.
We're talking about climate change and the environment here on No Limits. You can shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Got an email from a listener named Leslie in Carmel. Says, Indiana has one of the highest per capita carbon footprints in the world. What are the key policies needed to reduce our impact? What are the most serious climate impacts for Indiana? I think that one does seem to be pitched to you, Jesse Carbonda, the Hoosier Environmental Council.
Well, yes, and I think the good news is that there are proven cost-effective public policies out there to reduce the carbon footprint. To allude to the questioner's point that the state ranks first in the Midwest in its carbon footprint and somewhere between the second and fourth highest carbon footprint in the United States. One, we like to share an alphabet soup of public policies that people ought to be aware of, going back to this theme I've mentioned about how important it is to be a green-minded citizen. One piece of public policy that we'd like to see improved over the coming years is something called SB 251, or the Clean Electricity Standard. In principle, it's the type of public policy that ought to promote a lot more investment in renewable energy, but it's not been used by any of the electrical utilities in the state. We need to change it such that it will really induce our utilities to diversify away from coal.
We've gotten another email question from a listener named Elizabeth, who says, I can't recall the exact percentage, but can you comment on America's hunger for animal protein and its impact on global warming? It is my understanding that industrial farming specifically is having an even greater impact on climate change than the automobiles we drive. As an individual, if one would simply consume fewer animal products, we can make a great impact and live a more healthy life. How much of an impact is that having, Dennis Schock?
Well, I think that has a huge impact. I'm not sure exactly of the statistics on that as to which pollutes the most, but certainly our high consumption of meat, one of the highest consumption rates in the world, affects our climate in that we grow a lot of cattle, and that takes a lot of feed, and it has all kinds of related environmental issues involved with raising so many cattle to feed our hunger for meat. So I think by reducing how much meat we eat certainly does help. I'm not a vegetarian myself, but I have been cutting back on that, I noticed, and that's something I think all of us could do and probably be healthier for it.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Gene, it looks like, who says, what are the factors in balancing the kind of progress we need with preserving the history and character of state, federal, and local buildings? I'm assuming that's about figuring out ways to make them more energy efficient and using fewer traditional. I don't see anyone springing up necessarily eager to answer that one,
really?
But Jesse Carbondo responded to the call.
Well, I'll put a plug again for something called Property Assessed Clean Energy Bonds. This is, again, a public policy that's very Republican-friendly because it's private sector-driven and it's completely voluntary. The idea is that the legislature enacts legislation that would empower cities and counties to issue dedicated bonds, and those bonds could be used to then give to a historical building such that they could reduce their energy bill. And of course, you know, operating costs in terms of energy consumption are going to be particularly high for old buildings. So there's a particularly compelling return on investment and payback period in the context of investing in historical buildings. So it's something that we hope to get our friends in the historical building community behind.
And we've also gotten a question from a listener named Stephen, who is making reference to the Keystone Pipeline and I think taking issue to some degree with the panel, says, thinks that the oil needs to be used directly in the United States and says that the aquifer will never be affected. People who know these things feel frustrated that this isn't brought to light. I think that sounds to me more like a Kathy Licht question than anything else, the geology of it, I suppose. How likely is what Stephen's saying true?
Well, it is interesting that we are limited by our resources, and so there's a fantastic amount of petroleum products in Canada, and they would like to export those materials. We certainly also have a lot in this country. And I think we are limited by the geology and where these things occur. But things like the Ogallala Aquifer, no, the intent is certainly not to pollute it. But if there was a breach in the pipeline, for instance, you know, that the leak is potentially going to affect that area. And it is so important to drinking water, as Jesse mentioned, that I don't know that most people are willing to take the risk of losing drinking water when perhaps there are alternative solutions.
Jesse Carbonda.
Yes. I mean, I think that the siting risks are real. It, you know, it's been reflected by Republican governors in the Plains states who are very passionate about energy security and very passionate about increasing domestic energy production, who feel that the siting is very problematic. Furthermore, you know, you had a massive spill of several hundred thousand gallons of tar sands processed oil on the Kalamazoo River just a couple years ago. So for us, we feel like there's precedence.
And is that... That, though, is one of the arguments that, you know, the classic argument, Dennis Schock, you are nodding your head here, that, you know, that environmentalists are alarmist when they don't necessarily need to be. How do you combat that?
Well, yes, I hear
resistance.
That a lot, that, yeah. that we are alarmists. I feel very strongly that if the situation is alarming, then you need to call attention to that. If you have cancer, you want your doctor to tell you and tell you what the effects will be if you don't do anything. And that's basically the situation we have. Or you could say we're on the Titanic and we're headed for the iceberg. That's certainly alarming.
Full speed ahead, right?
Full speed ahead. But we have the option of changing direction. We don't have to hit that iceberg. So in one sense, it is alarming. In another sense, it's an opportunity.
Real quickly, in about 20 seconds, Kathy Licht, what is something that we could do as a state that would make a difference?
Yeah, I think Jesse has mentioned a lot of fantastic policies that I would encourage people to research and really, you know, if they're supportive of it, as you mentioned, contacting your local representatives can make a really important difference.
So call your legislators. What should you ask them for? Jesse Carbonda. What's your priority list?
The top three that we're focused on: public transit funding, some incentives to promote renewable energy and energy efficiency, and then something and to tackle the phosphorus problem. There's been a blue-green algae problem that's across the state that's affecting our $9 billion recreational industry. This is the type of win-win situation that would improve the economy and the environment. We hope people will register for our forum at hecweb.org.
Okay, do that. And tell them again real quickly about the symposium, how they get involved.
Sure. People can continue to register online until 3 p.m. today at hecweb.org. We are also accepting on-site registration, which starts at 8:30 on Saturday, December 1st. At the Schweitzer Center at the University of Indianapolis.
Okay, and very quickly, maybe in 15 seconds, Dennis Schock, what would you tell people to do?
I'm glad it's at the University of Indianapolis. That's my school. Graduate from that. I would tell people that our lifestyles are going to have to change. We're going to have to learn to conserve and put conserve back into conservative and learn to use wisely what the Creator has given us.
This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank all three of you for joining me today. Jesse Carbonda, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for being here. Kathy Licht, thank you for joining us today.
Thank
Enjoyed
you.
Talking with you. Dennis Schock, thank you very much for
You're
making
welcome.
The time today. We will be back next week when we're going to be talking about the intimidating world of adult online education. Scary, scary stuff, sort of. Not really. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.